Welcome to Between the Lines, an Oaks Church Brooklyn podcast where we go behind the scenes of our current series, The Story of God, alongside our pastors and a few friends. We hope you enjoy.
All right, we are back.
Back again.
Or I guess more aptly, I am back.
Yeah, you took a week off, you know, got away to retreat.
Been a long time. Should have left you.
We had fun with Aria, though.
Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, I wasn't jealous at all. you know, I was really glad to see you shine with someone else. I'm very thankful for Aria and the conversation you guys had. I thought it was really, really rich.
Shout out to Aria.
So, but we're back, and it's now time to start a new chapter.
Yeah. Wow. It's crazy because I feel like it's wild. We've all only been in one chapter so far. And yet it's also wild. We're already turning the page.
Exactly. Yeah. We've got, we're on second chapter of 15, the covenant of Abraham.
Yeah.
Which I thought you set up really well, the other week.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah, so this was jumping back into the story. I think, I don't know if people noticed this. But we kind of skipped, and I think this might be interesting for people who give their time to listen to this podcast.
Yeah, sure.
To know that we have a writer's room.
Yeah, yeah. Fun fact.
Yeah, fun. So a little inside baseball. We have a small team of people from our community who are screenwriters, who are also, you know, kind of armchair theologians, people who've really put a lot of time into the study of the scriptures, and people who are storytellers. And we meet monthly to kind of just say, hey, we are telling a story, and also we're telling a very expansive story while also trying to make sure that we keep the main thing the main thing,
right,
which is this is the story of God.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many like bit characters. It feels like if this was like a season, this would be like old school seasons of television.
Yeah, yeah.
Which someone, here's a fun fact. Do you know how many seasons of Gilligan Islands there was?
I have no clue.
Take a guess. Over, under,
10. I would say over, under 10.
Yeah.
I feel the way you're leading with this is that it's over.
There was 4 seasons of Gilligan Islands.
But how many episodes per season were there?
There you go.
Yeah.
33 episodes per season. Right? So I feel like it just feels like, hey, we're telling this story that like the Bible feels like short, but there's so much in between. So these people basically help us kind of keep the narrative going.
Yeah. No, they've been so super helpful in those conversations of, how do you tell this expansive story without like falling into the sin of like Marvel, where it's like everyone gets a spinoff?
Yeah.
Well, everyone can't get a spinoff right now.
Watch Echo. We didn't really need that.
Yeah.
But, but shout out Echo. But I bring that up to say, maybe the most carefully paying attention would have caught this, but when we left the story in last chapter was Noah, and we exited the ark, and I referenced Noah beginning to drink. Now, my original plan was that we would take from there and go into what happens on the back end of that decision.
Yeah.
And then we'd move to Abraham or Abram and then continue forward. But, we're taking a different tack, which is the one that we're on that I don't need to explain because we'll experience it. But that said, I thought it might be worthwhile because I did do a little bit of work and research on this and stuff like that to talk about what happens that moment.
Yeah.
Where if you aren't keeping on with our daily reading plan, I would encourage you to do so, but I'll let you in. Essentially, Noah comes off of the ark. He plants a vineyard, he makes wine, he gets drunk, and then there's this very interesting scene where his three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, are all around. Noah, in his drunkenness, is naked, he's in his tent, and his youngest son, Ham, goes into his tent, and the scripture says that he looked at his father, and then he comes out to his brothers and essentially tries to entice him to come also look at his father.
Yeah.
And the other two, Shem and Japheth, choose not to, and instead they can come in and they clothe their father and they put him to sleep. And then in the aftermath of this moment, there's a curse.
Yeah.
Where Noah doesn't curse Ham, the youngest son, but he curses Ham's son, Canaan.
Yeah.
And yeah, just through like, we should probably maybe talk about that.
Yeah, it's a very weird story. You know, I think in this story, I think people have a lot of ways to interpret that incident. I think it's what you do with the Hebrew kind of phrasing there is this phrasing ra'ah erwa, which is like to see nakedness.
Yes.
And so some people, they take a very literal approach. And so what we're dealing with here with Ham is like this kind of... patrilineal honor is very important in the ancient Near East. And so we're seeing essentially his Ham going into the tent, seeing his father naked, is going to his brothers and saying, hey, look, our father's naked, check it out, and dishonoring him. But in Leviticus, that same phrase, ra'ah erwa, has sexual overtones. Mm-hmm. And so what we might have here is this instance of Ham taking advantage of his father sexually. Mm. And so in both... according to several scholars, seem viable, but it's the intensity of the curse that makes one think, like, what happened here? And why does a whole line get cursed because of one man's decision?
Yeah. I come from the South. You're are the North, but we have a delineation between like naked, just meaning was without clothes on, and naked, which means like, no clothes and up to something.
Yeah.
Or they're probably, I don't know if you've ever heard this. You say, you know, if you're naked and your neighbors can't see you, that's rural.
Yeah.
If you're naked and your neighbors see you and call the cops, that's suburban. If you're naked on your porch and your neighbor ignores you, it's urban.
Yeah.
And if you're naked and your neighbor's naked, it's Florida. So what we have here is somewhat of a Florida man, not to me, but yeah, whatever happens, it is not a joke like I just made it. It is actually quite serious
because
it does result in a curse. But what's interesting, and I'm curious in your readings what you make of this, where we've seen curses, you know, Cain slays Abel, and there's this sort of curse, the serpent tricks Eve and there's a curse on the serpent. Ham is not cursed, but his son Canaan is.
Yeah. And so I think there's I think two ways that I've read that scholars try to reconcile this. One is this what's happening in the text is kind of, there's this kind of been this conflation of these two names, Ham and Canaan. Mm-hmm. And so when we read Canaan, we're reading Ham. But secondly, too, though, I think what we are, if we also, there's another scholarly point of view, what happens in the tent is that essentially some scholars posit that actually Ham possibly castrates his father in his drunkenness. And so the pronouncement against Cain is actually like enacting revenge. So too have you messed with my ability to produce life and my seed. So too now your seed will be cursed. And so I think those are two ways that text has been reconciled for me. But I would wonder what do you make sense of that pronouncement?
Yeah, I think you're bringing. I mean, those are definitely some prevailing points of view, scholarly wise. I think also there's a sense where there's something happening in the story. There's a polemic happening that is actually one that where I did end up starting this past week, which is on genealogies, right?
Mm, yeah.
And so there's a sense where what happens immediately after this kind of cursing of Canaan is when we get into this excursion of like all these genealogies that lead down. And so we go then from, you know, you have Canaan and this kind of like cursed son. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we can't ignore, and we should probably just touch that there has been, especially particularly in the history of US, an ideology
mm-hmm.
that said, you know, hey, because in these genealogies to follow in Genesis 10, there's some reference to like Nubians and darker skinned people,
mm-hmm.
That this curse of Ham was, or curse of Canaan was used to say, this is a justification for slavery.
Right. Because the curse is a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers.
Yes. Yes. And so that has been particularly in the, you know, transatlantic slave trade,
mm-hmm.
a justification and a rationale given by Puritans to say, like, hey, well, these people, this is their rightful place
mm-hmm.
in kind of the cosmos and the societal order is to be servants. Now, that's actually not what's happening here in the scriptures. But I think what's happening is that, again, we're talking about writers who are trying to distinguish themselves and their mm-hmm. children between who's in and who's out,
mm-hmm.
right? There's an article, my resource for the day, I'll talk about later, but there's an article by a guy named Mark McIntyre and Wongi Park, and they talk about the use of genealogies scripturally, and you kind of have two kind of uses. One would be like this kind of linear genealogy, like what we see in mm-hmm. the start of Matthew from David to Jesus, right? Where you're going like, hey, here's King David. Now, I want to tell you something about where I end Jesus by following this direct line. And then you have this other kind of genealogy, which is what we see in Genesis 10, where it's not so much linear, but it's this kind of expansive genealogy that says, look at these people, and we're talking about ethnics and culture. And we're trying mm-hmm. to say these people are in and these people are out. And so for me, the sense that I make is that this story is trying to highlight when the world falls apart post the flood, there's a good people and a bad people.
Yeah.
And the good people, the chosen people, well, they get passed down until we get to a man named Abram.
Yeah. And it's, I think if you were to do a careful reading of Ham's line, what you get is all of Israel's enemies are in Ham's line.
Exactly.
And so you see this kind of, this working out of, if we're going to justify our combat against these enemies, if we're going to, and especially in the conquest narratives, well, these are these peoples that have descended from, like, the very kind of black and white. This is the bad line.
Yes.
And so this justifies actually our coming into the land.
Yeah, this is who we are by showing who we aren't.
Right, exactly.
So, okay, so now we get into, you know, Abram, and this week we kind of dealt with the three fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah, the patriarchs, yeah.
Yeah, and there was a question that came right after the service that I would love for us to kind of talk about, and it came in different forms, but essentially it was a question around what sense, like how do we handle this whole take your son, the son that you love, and kill him.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm your boss. Like, I'm also your pastor. I don't know if you're like, oh, hey, Ryan, you know, you're about to have this son.
Yeah.
I feel like God is just, I got this sense that God is saying, I want you to go kill your son and prove
how much you love me.
Yeah, how much you love this church. You know?
Yeah, and, that'd be crazy.
I would hope you would file an HR complaint.
Yeah, more than that, probably.
Yes. what do you do with that?
Yeah, and so I guess whenever I come to this question, I want to ask first, how would our original, when we say original, the people most closest to these narratives would have read this story?
Sure.
And I think it's interesting to note, not that there's not tension here, but for ancient Israelite readers, there would have been like, I think a mix of tension and yet not tension, because child sacrifice is forbidden in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually one of the reasons for the conquest narratives is like in their pagan practice, there's this killing of innocents. And so it's something Yahweh condemns. So I think an ancient Israelite reader, they're saying, huh, this is interesting because I know Yahweh doesn't permit this. And in there maybe lies the tension for the ancient reader, which is, I know Yahweh doesn't permit this, but why is this happening? Mm. Where I think we as modern readers go, oh, child sacrifice? How could God ask that?
Yeah.
And so I think it's different questions. The ancient Israel is asking, we know our God doesn't allow this. So let's actually really pay attention here, because this seems to be not the norm. Versus I think as modern readers, we go, hold on, is this the kind of God that wants stuff like this? So different questions I think we're asking too.
I feel like I'm hearing you say, like, you're kind of speaking to where's your skepticism?
Yeah, exactly.
Know? Like, they don't have a skeptical view of God.
Yeah. They trust God.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe I just am not hearing this right. There's something wrong with me.
Yeah,
there's
something
I need to learn.
Versus we go the opposite way. Is there something wrong with God?
Yeah, because there's definitely nothing wrong with me in the way I perceive things.
Yeah, and I think, and then in part of that too is I think this narrative, I think it's also part of our tensions come from, and maybe you could speak to this a bit more, Patrick, too, is like, because you mentioned a bit in your sermon, but like how we've received this story, in that in our minds, we go to the young boy, Isaac, we imagine this kind of prepubescent young man kind of being dragged along by his father to his death, when that actually might not be what we should be envisioning.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that for me was a real turning point in understanding this story, because I was kind of raised with like this view of like, you know, I have a soon to be 5-year-old son, and it felt like, oh yeah, God was like, hey, go take your little boy and carry him up, and be like, oh, it's all fine, we're gonna go hang out for the day, and then just lay on this altar here, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But yet, and when you look at like the Talmudic traditions, and particularly like Lewis Ginsburg, who was this Russian Jew and Talmudic scholar, and he wrote this like expansive, it's like kind of like one of the seminal works of the Talmud of kind of going through these different stories. And it's interesting that he kind of refers to, it's called the Legends of the Jews, but in it he says that he estimates that Isaac was about 37. Mm. And where he's taking that from is if you look at right after this moment, Sarah dies.
Yeah.
And if you take her age then and subtract it from when she had Isaac, it's about 37 years.
Mm.
But what we do know, even in the text, it says that Abraham places on Isaac's back the wood for the altar.
Mm.
And so here is a person able to take the necessary wood for an altar up a mountain for a few days' journey. So we're actually not dealing with like a very small child. We're dealing with a full-grown man who wouldn't be overpowered by his father.
Yeah.
You know? And what that meant for me then was, oh, there's something else happening here. And there's someone who's so quiet. And I brought this up on Sunday. Typified in Isaac is a quiet faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like he doesn't say much of anything in his time in the story.
Yeah.
And the way I understand this passage is that the focus is on the fathers. And I want to circle back to that in a second. But what can't be lost is the son, the faithful son who also loves this God. This was also Isaac's God.
Yeah, he's the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Yes. Yeah.
Isaac also loved his God so much that he was willing to lay down his life. And when you get that and you see like this picture, this proto-Jesus.
Yeah.
Right? He's carrying the wood up the mountain to his supposed death.
Yeah.
But where the focus is not on the son, it is on the fathers, because I think what you're bringing up, the social, the societal context from which these stories arose, child sacrifice did happen in the ancient world. But I do think it's worthwhile to say it did not happen lightly. It wasn't pervasive.
Yeah.
And when it did happen, it was a desperate measure to either appeal to the movement of their God or to appease a severe wrong done to their God, right? Because children are precious. Like, they're literally life.
Yeah.
And I think what I see, and I'm curious, I mean, I want to hear you speak a little bit more as an impending father, how this finds you.
Yeah.
What's being said here is that where these other gods, this is what you need to make them move. This is what you need to make them take up your cause. This is what you need to make things right with them. You have to kill your precious son. But Yahweh, Elohim, no, he actually doesn't want that. He's creating a situation where he says, this is not who I am. And then next time we get in a similar situation, we'll see that not only does he not require your son, he actually gives his son for you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's like the...
How's that hit you, soon to be your dad?
Yeah, as a new dad. I think there's this moment, and I think it's something we gloss over so easily because we know the story. But in verse 8, Abraham said, God will provide for himself the land for a burnt offering, my son. Responding to Isaac's question, like, hey, we got everything, but where's the lamb? And it's funny because Abraham knows exactly what God, and so you could read this as like he's trying to like appease his son and trick him. Or you could say, this is actually what Abraham believes. I know so much about the character of this God that I'm willing, that I know, even though he's asked me this, he will provide a way. And I think coming into fatherhood and this kind of order, this great love I feel for this child, like it frames so much what Abraham is facing, which is, this child is so precious to me. God, even though you've asked of us, I also know something of you that you will make a way, that you will not let me go through this. And I think this is, we're seeing here where like Abraham earns his moniker, the father of faith. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, as a believer, as someone who's about to be a father, there is this great trust born whenever you have a life in your hands that you're saying, like, God, like, this life belongs to you, and yet it's also mine's. And like, I know I'm a steward, but I really care about this thing. Yeah. I'm stewarding. And I don't know, something that there's is something that the fatherly, not just Abraham's trusting, but that fatherly protection, like, I don't want to sacrifice my son. I know, and I also know, God, something about you that you don't. And I that hits me, I think, as a soon-to-be father, of like, this child is yours, Lord. I know this. It is a gift from you. And yet, it's also mine's. And so, forgive me, Lord, if I offer you this child so flippantly.
Yeah. Do you think you could do it? Do you think you would have?
Man, I'll say this. I mean, I'm not the father of faith, so probably not. But I think, I'll say this. There's something of Abraham at this point in the story, for all his mess ups and swindling and violence, you can, and that's why I love even the beginning of that chapter where it says, after these things, which is this kind of literary turn where, so after all these things have happened, this is like the culmination of the story. I would hope that after all God has shown me of his own character in my own life, that I would have the sense of Abraham's understanding of Yahweh, that I would say, I know you're asking this, and yet I know something about your core nature, that this also isn't what you're asking in some way. I don't know. So all I'll say, that's a non-answer.
Yeah, I see that.
But I don't know. I probably, right now, no.
Yeah.
I'm fighting.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to think. Well, I don't know if I would like to think. When I allow my hubris and ego to become me, I would say, oh, yeah, for sure. But, like, you know, there's that part in Hebrews 11, verse 19, where it says that Abram reasoned in his heart that if necessary, God would bring Isaac from the dead.
Yeah.
Like, his view of God, talk about where's your cynicism. His view of God was such that he just believed, this God is so faithful to me that even if I go through with this, he will reorder the natural law of this universe to stay faithful to me.
Yeah.
And what's true about my life is I don't often believe that.
Yeah. It is, I think, again, there's this great G.K. Chesterton quote, and I always butcher it, but there is something about Christianity hasn't been tried and found wanting, but it has been tried and found difficult. Yeah. And I think this is one of these moments where, yeah, like, faith, grace, these things, do we actually believe these things?
Yeah. Well, we got to start wrapping this up. So I think this is a good point to kind of like seed and look ahead to next week. So we're going to be part of what came out of that writer's room was, hey, let's, there's so much here. We're literally tackling 22 chapters of scripture. And there's all these characters that reveal different things about God. Let's kind of split it up. And so where we've gone through these fathers, these men, next week we're going to go through this kind of the same story through the women. I think something I would speak to just as we come into that is, you know, talking to my wife and just here and other women. And this is something I kind of understand rationally and theoretically, but I don't have the embodied, like lived realization of, is the way in which the womb and childbirth is essentially like the shadow of death over a woman's life, almost from the moment she's born.
Yeah.
Like the thought that what you do with motherhood, you know, I was talking to my wife and she's like, yeah, it's pervasive. It determines on like, what am I willing to do to secure someone who will make me a mother? What am I willing to do? What job am I going to take a job? Am I going to go to school? Where am I going to live? How, like everything is just structured around the womb. And that's in this modern time where there are more options available to women than ever, thank goodness. And yet it's the same angst and anxiety that exists for the women we're about to cover, even just multiplied because the very likelihood, like their chance of survival as a community, rest on their wombs. Not to mention, you know, God blessing the whole world.
Yeah. It's funny. It, you know, just coming full circle, this is what Eve hears from Yahweh, which is the great pain is not the physical pain of childbirth, but it's all that is wrapped up in the burden of being the one through whom life is given.
Yeah. So that's where we're
that's where we're gonna
sit with next week. All right, as we get out of here, I would love for us to just take a moment to cut a point to a resource we would recommend for people that can kind of just help them do their own study. So you got one you wanna offer?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned her before, but Ellen Davis is this Old Testament scholar. She's quite brilliant, and she wrote a book which is a collection of some of her lectures she's given on the Old Testament called Opening Israel Scriptures. And I think while we're in the story of God, and particularly in Israel's story in the Old Testament, this resource kind of points to this, and she kind of, this is what she kind of explores in it, that what we will see is, I think we confuse uniformity with coherence, and that she, and her argument is, The Israel scriptures isn't this uniform kind. It's not like a modern novel.
Sure.
And yet each of these individual works have this speak to each other coherently. And I think it's a really helpful resource.
Sweet. Great. I got two. One is just the article I referenced earlier, Ethnic Fission and Fusion in Biblical Genealogy. It's just a great resource to kind of understand more about what's happening in Genesis 10 in particular, but in other places. So that'll be in the footnotes. And then the second one is a dear friend of mine. Long ago, it's funny how things come back around, but when we were in college, for his senior thesis, wrote an album about the narratives of Genesis, and it's called Valley Maker. And it is, I just revisited since we're like here, and it has had such a richness just to kind of think about and process some of the questions that are happening. And I would just highly recommend it. So give it a listen. But I guess I'll see you next week, my friend.
Next week.
All right, Between the Lines.